This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, June 17th, 2003. Cameras and microphones that capture what you see and hear. Sensors that record what you feel. Global positioning satellite sensors that log every movement. Biomedical sensors that monitor vital signs. Internet activity, telephone calls, and voicemail stored. Mail and faxes scanned. Links to every radio, television broadcast heard, and every newspaper, magazine, book, website, or database seen is recorded. Sound like Brave New World? This is LifeLog, a project of the Pentagon's Defense Advanced Research Agency, DARPA. Also, top secret worldwide attack matrix that specifies individual targets to be assassinated in 80 countries around the world. According to Bob Woodward and Dan Baltz in the Washington Post, January 31, 2002, CIA Director George Tenet brought this to President George Bush on September of 2001. Here we have, from Murder Incorporated to Total Control, the architecture of the police state, Taking Aim for today. Ralph?
DARPA is now advancing to the Brave New World with a rapidity that could not have been anticipated when it was first put into place. Noah Shachman describes in the globalsecurity.org site an important piece called A Spy Machine of DARPA's Dreams, precisely what this entails. A memory aid, a robotic assistant, an epidemic detector, an all-seeing ultra-intrusive spy program. The Pentagon has embarked on a stunning research project which will gather every conceivable bit of information about a person's life, index this information, make it searchable, and put it at the disposal of the Pentagon. What national security experts and civil libertarians want to know is, where does this end? The LifeLog program dumps everything an individual does into a giant database. Every email sent and received, every photograph taken, every web page started, every phone call made, every TV show watched, every magazine read, and all of this and more, combined with information gleaned from a great variety of sources, a GPS transmitter that keeps tabs on where every individual goes, audio-visual sensors which capture what he or she sees or says, biomedical monitors that monitor and keep track of the individual's daily health. This gigantic amalgamation of personal information deployed to trace the threads of an individual's life in totality in order to document exactly how every relationship develops, according to a briefing for the Defense Advanced Project Research Agency LifeLog sponsor. Those with access to this beta database will retrieve all of this data and a specific thread of all past transactions and recall of experience from a few seconds ago to many years before, deploying the search engine interface. This is the latest in the long line of DARPA's blue sky research, which is going to effect total control over every minutiae and aspect of every individual's life permanently.
DARPA, for which the information component is directed by former Admiral John Poindexter, who brought us originally the Total Information Awareness Plan. Now, this was supposedly shelved by Congress after much dissent throughout the United States. Now, the Total Information Awareness was going to compile on computers all commercial credit card data, individual bank and academic records, and maintain this with FBI and CIA dossiers. It isn't really off the shelves. It has now emerged once again as part of the Terrorist Information Awareness Plan that was submitted May 20th, 2003 to Congress in its in DARPA's report. Instead of calling its program Total Information Awareness, it is now reinvented as Terrorist Information Awareness. And LifeLog, which Ralph and I have been describing, is one of the components, Cognitive Computing Research. And what DARPA has done is sent out bids for four research contracts to develop what it calls perceptive assistance that learns. In other words, feeding in all this computerized information about individuals such that the computers, these very large supercomputers, can analyze it and supposedly determine who is going to be a terrorist and who is not, or who is a dissenter and who is not, which organization is a so-called threat to the capitalist power structure, and which organizations are not. Since 1996, according to the DARPA document, which is available on the Internet, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency has been developing information technologies to counter what they call asymmetric threats, what their term is for so-called terrorists, or in other words, resistance movements. Now, DARPA created the Information Awareness Office, the IAO, in January 2002 to integrate the myriad projects that corporations in Silicon Valley and in the other technology centers throughout the United States have been developing. DARPA works with the U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command, INSCOM, and the Information Dominance Center, the Information Operations Center, along with many of the intelligence agencies of which we're familiar. The National Security Agency, which, by the way, collects billions of pieces of information each day, such as telephone calls and faxes. The Defense Intelligence Agency, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Department of Defense's Counterintelligence Field Activity, the U.S. Strategic Command, STRATCOM, the Special Operations Command, SOCOM, the Joint Forces Command, JFCOM, and the Joint Warfare Analysis Center, JWAC. Ralph?
Let's look at the full implication of this totalitarian construct, which is becoming a central feature of capitalist rule. Defense analyst for the Federation of American Scientists, Stephen Aftergood, was very, very clear about what this entails. This gigantic amalgamation of personal information will be used to trace the threads of an individual's life at every moment, at every second. With the controversial DARPA planning to track all individual transaction data, such as what we buy and who gets our email and with whom we speak in the confines of a bedroom or in a coffee shop, there is nothing that will go undetected and unevaluated for the purpose of determining how to control the individual in question. LifeLog has the potential to become TIA Cube, Aftergood declared. In the private sector, LifeLog is already dictating to industry to structure what is called a surrogate memory of the behavior of individuals from one moment to the next, as mini computer pioneer Gordon Bell described it. Now, the LifeLog takes this concept several steps further by tracking what people see when they go to a given place. John Pike, who was director of the defense think tank Global Security, stated that the military will have control over efficient computerized systems for tracking and detecting the behavior and intentions of every individual. Indeed, the LifeLog will be training robotic assistants to facilitate this programming of data and monitoring of individuals in the society. It will become a way to profile suspected terrorists, said Cory Doctorow with Electronic Frontier Foundation. Quote, in other words, an agent of Osama bin Laden, presumptive agent, takes a walk around the block at 10 o'clock in the morning and buys a bagel and a newspaper at the corner store and then calls his mother. You do the same thing, i.e., you are an Al-Qaeda member. Anything that you do or another human being does, which is constructed to be parallel, immediately demarcates you as an equivalent figure. It is a license to monitor and determine the fate of every living person through the monitoring of our behavior, our routines, I'm quoting, our relationships, our habits, which will be then recreated in digital form.
What DARPA's premise, according to their documents, is that by discovering linkages, that is, networks, connections, among people, places, things, and events, as well as what you buy, read, and so forth, and by training the software, the algorithm, the programming decisions to recognize patterns of relationships, much in the way that social networking is done by sociologists, that by looking at these complex patterns of relationships that they say are representative of terrorist groups, because they would feed in information that's been accumulated by the CIA and the FBI about so-called groups and individuals, that by establishing these patterns, they will identify who is a potential terrorist, what is a potential terrorist group, with the very software tools. And then they would have the intelligence agencies go after them. But now, it is not just was so-called terrorism. They have other programs, such as MINDET, the Misinformation Detection System. And that, by the way, has been looking at things such as from the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission. What they did to test misinformation detection was they looked at filings for the SEC. And they actually had a very substantial amount of accuracy about the companies that the SEC went after in terms of its corporate filings. So you can imagine, here you have with things such as MISINDET being put with any record that you happen to fill out and all of a sudden deciding that you are lying. Ralph?
The Washington Times on June 5th described the LifeLog project as a grave privacy concern. Coming to you from the Pentagon, the diary to end all diaries, the multimedia digital record of everywhere you go, everything you see, everything you hear, read, say, and touch. Again, this article amplifies what has been spelled out in the articles and in the documents that we have cited up to this moment. The project is now put out for contractor bids by the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. This is not an abstract or a theoretical or a research undertaking. It is an operational plan that is being implemented as we speak. Quote, the goal is to create the breakthrough software that will control behavior, habits, and routines, according to Pentagon documents reviewed by the Associated Press. The products of the project will be available to selective elements in the private sector and government agencies. John Pike of Global Security stated the following, I have a much easier time understanding how Big Brother will want to deploy this than how Rumsfeld will use it. They have not identified a true military application. A true military application. Look, brothers and sisters, it comes down to the very concept of terror, the false category of terror, the labeling of the very impulse to dissent, the capacity to question, the willingness to follow one's own lights in life, the capacity to dissociate oneself from whatever government propaganda is thrust at us. It is this capacity to think for ourselves, to act out of intellectual independence, to function as free individuals, that is the target, that is the threat, that is defined as something that makes the self-respecting individual an enemy of the state.
Ralph, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, has a new report called Freedom Under Fire, Dissent in Post 9/11 America, which also is available on the Internet. It was published in May of 2003. And in this important report from the ACLU, they document some of the reaction across the United States during the in which the anti-war movement participated, that particularly tried to stifle any dissent in the country. And they go through, in the beginning, a historical analysis that goes all the way back to the Alien Act of 1798, in which President John Adams gave himself the power to deport any non-citizen that he personally judged dangerous. And although it was never enforced, according to the ACLU, a companion sedition act was implemented that suppressed freedom of the press. And again, they refer to President Abraham Lincoln, who suspended the writ of habeas corpus during the Civil War, and particularly to President Woodrow Wilson, who enacted an espionage act of 1917 that was used to mount a full-scale assault, according to the ACLU, on free speech, where Wilson had the Justice Department prosecute more than 2,000 critics of World War I, and judges, they note, were quick to hand down harsh punishments. Then in 1918, Congress enacted a Sedition Act, which restricted criticism of the government, the Constitution, the flag, and the military. There's a long history in the United States of stifling dissent.
My father actually had, who was a founder of the ACLU, once wrote a piece called We Are the Civil Liberties Boys, in which he documented the remarkably sparing and few occasions in American history when civil liberties have been honored, respected, or enforced. The overwhelming history of this country has been that of the repression of dissent, and it follows from this that this now 1984 Brave New World DARPA lifelong utilization of the total control over individual feelings and actions and thoughts and perceptions is now put at the disposal of those in power. It flows from this that we understand this is not a question of technical hocus-pocus. It is not a question of worshiping or falling down before the all-powerful aspect of the computer technology that's at the disposal of authority. It's about understanding that power, the structure of power, the 2% that controls 90% of the national wealth, requires control over the population and deploys the state as its instrument of coercive control. This technology is an expression of the crisis of a capitalist system that cannot allow dissent, challenge, because of the degree of repression of and exploitation that a system in crisis visits upon the mass of our people. That is why the false category of terror, the word with which people are stigmatized, whether it's subversive, whether it's agitator, whether it's terrorist or what have you, there is always a swear word to attach to people who challenge authority and who pose the question of the right of these people to rule over the society without democratic entitlement. That is the core of the question, the core of the matter here. This DARPA is but the little continuation of the mechanisms of repression of a class war of the tiny handful of oligarchs who control the state apparatus to preserve their economic and political system. We must not be blinded by the technology, even as we point to the police state, meaning the totalitarian content of capitalist rule in a period of capitalist crisis and decay.
So when the ACLU was founded in 1920, it was in reaction to these roundups, the roundup of the Espionage and Sedition Acts of 1917 and 1918, where people were deported without trial. including many anarchists and people who were accused of being Bolsheviks. If you remember, there were the Palmer raids. Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, who tried to stop political unrest in rounding up 5,000 people in 33 cities over 2 months in 1920, and they were deported without trial. Now, this is very similar to what's happening now with the registration of Arab Americans here in the United States, 13,000, and of the people who were forced to register, now there is talk of deporting them wholesale. In terms of what is taking place, if you recall last year, the Patriot Act, right on the heels of the attacks on the World Trade Center in 2001, the Patriot Act was rushed through Congress. Now, it wasn't something new. It was a reworking of past laws, and it went through Congress almost unopposed. And now it was released recently, a Patriot Act 2. In June of 2003, Attorney General John Ashcroft, in speaking before Congress, defended the treatment of the 762 immigrants who were rounded up after September 11th. He said he makes no apologies for holding suspects as long as necessary to determine whether they had so-called links to terrorism. In fact, none of the 762 suspects were ever charged. And what Ashcroft went on to say to Congress, that in fact he thinks tougher penalties, including the death penalty, is necessary and that Congress must act swiftly. Quote, "We must make it crystal clear that those who train for and fight with a designated terrorist organization can be charged under the material support statutes." Those are the words of Attorney General John Ashcroft. Now, I mention this because recently labor unions such as the San Francisco Labor Council have been discussing what are the implications of Patriot Act and Patriot Act 2 for workers throughout the United States, not just the impingement of their civil liberties, but what it actually does in terms of organizing trade unions. Ralph?
The efforts of the San Francisco Labor Council and of labor activists in the Bay Area, and particularly those of the Open World Congress for Open World Conference for Trade Union Independence and Democratic Rights, of which Maya had been a co-coordinator for many years. These efforts have led to not only a delineation of the totalitarian implications and Police Act meaning of Patriot Acts 1 and 2, which is, I think, extremely important because it engages and involves organized labor in the resistance to this repression. But in particular, this campaign includes the demand for the rights of Iraqi workers to unionize and to have their labor rights respected. I have to say that as important as this campaign is, the framing of it has implications as well. For example, the first democratic right of Iraqi workers is surely an end to the occupation. It isn't a question of demanding that the corporations that are raping Iraq and that preside over the invasion of Iraq and the imperial longstanding plan to capture control, it isn't a question of merely and only demanding the democratic organizing rights. Important as that is, we have to also be clear that the framing of this is within a context of opposition to the violation of the most fundamental right of that people, not to be conquered, not to be occupied, not to have their government overthrown by an imperial power. And with respect to weapons of mass destruction, it's important, as the labor activists are doing, to expose, as many people are now doing, the lies about weapons of mass destruction in the hands of Saddam Hussein. But the question, of course, is, does the United States and does imperialism enjoy, and are we to grant them the right to determine whether a country has the right to arm itself? Is it the call of American imperialism to determine whether even a Saddam Hussein or Iraq under his rule has the right to self-defense? I don't believe so. It's the turd in the punch bowl. The framework is the critical aspect, because we don't want to give a deeply reactionary content to demands for workers' rights by failing to expose and oppose the imperial meaning of the American presence in Vietnam. Yes, there's discussion of the opportunity that arises from the removal of a tyrant. But who imposed that tyrant? How did Saddam Hussein come to power? It was American imperialism who imposed him. The death squads of the Iraqi regime were initiated by the Mossad and the Central Intelligence Agency when Saddam Hussein was imposed in Iraq. Context is critical. Political understanding flows from that. We have to frame our struggle for rights within an ideological understanding of the meaning of American policy and of how best to build a resistance to it.
Well, Ralph, let's go back to the report of the San Francisco Labor Council, which was prepared with discussion with the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU. The title of the report is Completing the Architecture for a Police State, as a question. But in fact, the conclusion is that the Patriot Acts 1 and 2 are completing the architecture for the police state. And the labor and the trade unions go on and describe in great detail what are the elements of the Patriot Act that prevent the organizing of labor and the threats to labor for supporting picket lines, civil disobedience, for having strikes, and for supporting solidarity with labor people, workers in Latin America and elsewhere in the world. In particular, what the Patriot Act 2 would do is it shifts the burden from the government to the defendants for various crimes that are labeled as terrorists or providing material support or resources for terrorism. Now, all this is at the discretion of the president and the attorney general. And then it removes a statute of limitation for these offenses so that prosecutors, according to the Labor Council, can go after unions and individual officers or members for nonviolent acts that took place several years before. And if something is considered in the American interest, such as the shipping industry, there is a risk that the Patriot Acts will be used against the trade unionists, for instance, against the ILWU, which was in contract negotiations with the shippers. And at the time, Tom Ridge had threatened to call out the military to work the docks and called the shipping industry in the national defense. Now, what the trade unionists say is that under the new Patriot Act and with Patriot Act 2, this would put the trade unions in jeopardy of having RICO, the organized crime statute, used against the trade unions for defense of their own contract negotiations and if they were to set up a picket line. Ralph?
Well, what's important and interesting about this expose of the real meaning of the Patriot Act, in particular how it is intended to not only target the population in general and to terrorize the people of the United States, but has a specific meaning with respect to the labor movement and workers' struggles in this country. It is intended to prevent the use of the classic instrument of class defense, the strike. It is intended to impugn striking as aid to terrorism and as a threat to national security. It's interesting that the St. Petersburg Times addressed itself to these questions with regard to the Democratic Party. And it quotes on June 14th, describes a meeting in Iowa of the Democratic Party candidates who much of organized labor is engaged in supporting. And it refers to Senator Bob Graham, who campaigned in Iowa last weekend and purportedly expressed himself as being unhappy with the Patriot Act's threat to civil liberties. He stated he was, quote, unhappy with Attorney General John Ashcroft's implementation of the anti-terrorism law. But as the St. Petersburg Times observes, Graham neglected to mention an important fact. He co-wrote the Patriot Act. He co-wrote the Patriot Act. As the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, he wrote major sections of the bill. As a presidential candidate, he's loath to mention the fact. Instructive, and perhaps it'll be worthy of instruction to those who have illusions about the Democratic Party. It doesn't merely stop with Senator Graham. As the St. Petersburg Times points out, the other candidates in the Democratic presidential race voted for the legislation. Quote, the issue is kind of tricky. On the one hand, it's terrific to take on Ashcroft and complain about government intrusion and excessive police powers. On the other hand, we don't want to be defending terrorists. It's kind of awkward. This ambivalence extends to Dennis Kucinich. Kucinich stated, we should not let the actions of the terrorists cause us to reject our American system of justice. Kucinich is opposing aspects of the Patriot Act, but he frames it within an understanding that the terrorists should not induce us to restrict or infringe our civil liberties, but the basic and fundamental issue here remains that the category of terror is the ideological rationale for the entire apparatus of repression, as it is for World War IV, as it is for whipsawing the American people into numbed acquiescence into imperial aggression abroad and repression at home. Labor must take the challenge and break with the Democratic Party, because by raising the question of repression while embracing its collaborators and authors, it paints itself into a political corner. It prepares for our co-option, our demobilization, and our ultimate impotence before the driven apparatus of the repressive state, an apparatus that the Democratic Party is equally involved in implementing and imposing, in rationalizing, and in maintaining.
From Murder Incorporated to Total Control, the architecture of the police state. You are listening to Taking Aim,
Ralph Schoenman,
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, listener-sponsored radio, and on the Internet at www.wbai.org. You can also hear archives of Taking Aim at our website, takingaim.info, www.takingaim.info. Now, in the second half, we want to discuss Murder Incorporated. I spoke at the top of the show of CIA Director George Tenet's document, Top Secret, Worldwide Attack Matrix, which specifies individual targets in 80 countries around the world. Now, the CIA prepared a memorandum of notification, which President Bush has authorized in terms of CIA assassinations with the specific lists and also open-ended lists, a license to kill that has been granted to the CIA. In fact, we know that over the years, the CIA has always had a license to kill, in much the same way as the Israeli Mossad and the British intelligence. And we're going to discuss all three today. Wayne Madsen, a former employee of the National Security Administration, the NSA, wrote an important article January 31st, 2002, that I came across recently, called J'accuse, Bush's Death Squads. And in it, he elaborates assassinations that took place around the world with CIA complicity, if not overtly by the CIA, very soon after this top secret worldwide attack matrix was released. Among them are Faiz Elue, January 31st, 2002, the Indonesian Army Chief General Endiantono Sutarto confirmed in Jakarta that the West Papua Independence Leader Faiz Elue was assassinated by Indonesian Army units after he was kidnapped November 11th, 2001. The assassins were member of COPASUS, a special operations unit trained by the U.S. Special Forces and CIA personnel that had been involved in the massacres in East Timor. Now, LUA was an activist against Freeport McMoRan, a Louisiana-based mining company that has pillaged West Papua's natural resources and has been accused of propping up the local Indonesian army and COPASUS officers with bribes and favor. Another assassination that took place at the same time, Abdullah Sayafi, January 22, 2002, again in Indonesia. Army troops assassinated the military commander of the Free Aceh Movement, Abdullah Sayafi. Now, the Free Aceh Movement demands independence for Aceh, which is a region in northwest Sumatra. And it's a struggle that is very much in the news today, a very long-standing struggle. Now, what people don't realize is that in Aceh, it is one of the oil centers of the Indonesian islands, the archipelago. And ExxonMobil has extensive drilling and refining operations in the territory. So that's two assassinations that took place, one right after the other, soon after this worldwide attack matrix was exposed. Again, he mentions Eli Hobeika. Now, Eli Hobeika had been a leader of the Lebanese Forces militia and very much involved with Israel during the 1982 occupation of Beirut and the massacres at Sabra and Shatila.
It was Hobeika who said, if you want to find out how many Palestinians we've killed, you'll have to dig a subway under Beirut.
What's interesting about Hobeika is that when there was a war crimes tribunal in Belgium, he agreed to testify that Ariel Sharon, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, was not just knew of the massacres, but that he had authorized the mass murder in his role as Israeli Defense Minister in 1982.
Hobeika was going to give evidence about not just the authorization, but the organizing, the sending of Israeli military commanders into wearing militia uniforms, as we have documented in our own eyewitness accounts since we were in Sabra and Shatila shortly after the massacre, 40 minutes after the last wave of slaughter. Yes, Hobeika had broken. Hobeika had broken because of the role of the Mossad in killing many of his cohorts in Lebanon itself. Maya, you were mentioning West Papua and the series of assassinations that were unfolded there. It should be mentioned that Henry Kissinger was director emeritus on the board of Freeport, as was Senator Louisiana Senator J. Bennett Johnston, who was a principal lobbyist for Emeron, the Democratic and Republican parties, deeply involved in the companies that required and benefited from the organized assassinations. This is a long-standing essential aspect of American imperial policy. If we take, for example, the assassinations that unfolded across Guatemala from 1952 to 1954, preparatory to the overthrow of the Arbenz regime, this was not just on the watch of Eisenhower. The entire apparatus for a CIA putsch in Guatemala, prepared by assassination of village leaders, of guerrilla leaders, of intellectuals, of students, of opponents to American imperialism in Latin America, came about under Harry Truman. Implemented by Truman, the putsch prepared by Truman, the assassinations initiated by Truman, the coup de grace administered by Eisenhower in 1954.
Ralph, but we should remark what happened to Hobeika. He was assassinated just before he was to testify and go to Belgium to testify by a car bomb that exploded near his SUV in Beirut. Now, this was prepared by the Israeli Mossad, and both Hobeika and his bodyguards were assassinated. You mentioned Guatemala, and I came across this article by Kate Doyle and Peter Kornbluth, and it's called CIA and Assassinations, the Guatemala 1954 Documents. And Ralph, it goes into great detail just what you were talking about. Operation PB Success was among several hundred records released by the CIA May 23, 1997, that specify its involvement in the 1954 coup in Guatemala. Now, they only declassified 1,400 pages, and Kornbluth and Doyle state that there are at least 100,000 pages in the secret archives on the Guatemalan destabilization program. And one of the things that was released specifically was a document that goes through, quote, executive action, that is, murder, imprisonment, and exile, and there was an A list of those to be assassinated, which contained 58 names, all of which were excised in the release documents, but you could see that there were 58 names particularly named for this assassination program in Guatemala.
Well, I think this goes to the point that we wish to emphasize emphatically. The articles in The Guardian on August 13, 2002, U.S. considers and prepares assassination squads. The BBC documentation on August 13th, U.S. organizes assassination squads, Special Operations Command, Delta Force, the Navy SEALs to carry out assassinations across the board in over 80 countries across on the planet, citing, for example, the 50,000 Vietnamese and Laotians killed during Operation Phoenix, the School of the Assassins, as it must properly be called, the School of the Americas, which prepares the death squads and trains the assassins across Latin America, Executive Order 12333, which limited assassinations, as Jane's Intelligence Review states, has been wiped out, pushed aside, not even the formal bureaucratic restraint of assassination will remain in place. It is the touchstone, the linchpin of imperial policy, death squads and assassinations from one end of the planet to the other. This is the hallmark of American imperial control, and it goes to the question once again, the category of terror mask the fact that the terror state is the capitalist state itself in the United States. The terror masters are the Bushes and the Rumsfelds and the Tenets and the Woolseys. The Rumsfelds and Cheneys are the implementers of a state terror apparatus on a global scale to repress our people at home and to murder dissidents and oppositionists in every country in the world.
You may recall that in January, we spoke of an article by Richard Sale, the United Press International Intelligence Correspondent, where he revealed that with the appointment to the Israeli Mossad's directorship of, that's the Secret Intelligence Service, Foreign Intelligence Service in Israel, of Meir Dagan, and that Ariel Sharon, Prime Minister of Israel, was preparing a huge budget increase for the spy agency, and that Israel openly was saying that it was going to assassinate whoever it pleased in any country of the world. Now, this has been long-standing Mossad policy, as we just spoke before of the assassination of Hobeika and many others throughout the years. And this followed on the release, the open statement by the United States that it was going to assassinate people on its hit list anywhere in the world, in countries of friend or foe. An important article appeared on June 12th in the Asia Times. It's written by Richard Bennett, and it's called Assassination and the License to Kill. Richard Bennett is the author of Elite Forces, an Encyclopedia of Secret Armies, and also another book that deals with the Encyclopedia of Spies and Secrets called Espionage. And in this book, in this article in the Asia Times, Assassination and the License to Kill, he talks about the world of counterterrorism, a world of the British operations, the Mossad operations, and the CIA. And he speaks of Rafi Eitan, who had been the head of Israel's counterterrorism operations for many years through many prime ministers, but particularly in the 1970s, and had organized the hit squad known as Kidom, which means bayonet in Hebrew. And Rafi Eitan, no relationship to Rafael Eitan, the general, had toured Northern Ireland and spoke with the British about the Special Air Services, the SAS, and the fact that their kill rate wasn't as high as it should have been. And within months of his visit, according to Bennett, there began a number of fundamental changes in Great Britain, including the establishment of the Mobile Reconnaissance Force, the MRF, which later became the notorious Force Reconnaissance Unit in Northern Ireland, the Assassination Bureau, which not only assassinated the people of the IRA, but also is responsible for the double agents within the IRA. And also he speaks of the Mossad and its operations, such as 1988, killing three IRA members in Gibraltar, an operation because the Israelis considered that the IRA were running guns from Lebanon. Throughout the world, you have the operations of the CIA, British intelligence, and the Mossad. Ralph?
What's happening here very clearly is that the techniques of the Mossad, which are the most notorious in their ruthlessness and in their relentlessness, are being now assimilated and employed by the Central Intelligence Agency and by its collateral and its subordinate agencies, such as British intelligence and other imperial and capitalist regimes. The Mossad, the world's most efficient killing machine, writes Gordon Thomas on the 9th of December. Standing on a canteen table in downtown Tel Aviv, Israeli spy master studied the men and women of the Mossad. In the few weeks since taking over Mossad, Maya Dagan knew he has already commanded something his recent predecessors never managed, respect. Barely raising his voice, he's described the Palestinians that he fights, and the Lebanese as well. When I was fighting in Lebanon, I witnessed the aftermath of a family feud. The patriarch's head was split open and his brain was on the floor. Around him lay his wife and some of the children, all dead. Before I could do anything, one of our people scooped up a handful of brains and swallowed it. This is how you will all now operate. Otherwise, someone will eat your brain, unquote. His every word held them in thrall. Even if they sent a shudder through some of his listeners, hardened as they were. In the canteen were those who had killed many, many times in countries across the world. Killing people who could not be brought to trial was the specialty. Only the Mossad would find and kill them. Rafi Eitan, the legendary former operations chief of Mossad, spoke to me as we sat together in his living room in a North Tel Aviv suburb. Quote, "I always try to kill when I can see the whites of a person's eyes, so I can see the fear, smell it on his breath. Sometimes I use my hands, a knife, or a silenced gun. I never felt a moment's regret over a killing." Meir Amit, director of the Mossad, later said, "We are like the official hangman, the doctor on death row. We administer the lethal injection. Our actions are endorsed by the State of Israel. When the Mossad kills, it is fulfilling a sentence sanctioned by the Prime Minister of the day." And the article proceeds to document how in country after country, the Mossad and its Kidon target those who are considered to be opponents of Zionism or the Israeli state. Yes, anybody who is in fact critical, in opposition, or who organizes political resistance to the policies of the Israeli state is a candidate for assassination. The Mossad's killing machine comes to the United Kingdom. According to the report by Gordon Thomas on June 15th, the Israeli intelligence agency has sent members of its Kidon assassination squad to join 15 hand-picked Katzas, its relentless field agents. Their brief is to disable close to 50 British Muslims. 50 British Muslims. In Mossad speak, disable means taking them out permanently, said an MI5 source grimly. We know from past experience that the Kidon make murder look like an accident. It is their specialty. Former Mossad chief Maya Ahmed said, sex is a weapon of the women agents. Pillow talk is not a problem for them. It takes a particular kind of discipline to sleep with the enemy prior to killing them. This is the apparatus that Rafi Eitan described as being applicable in nominally friendly countries, such as Great Britain and the United States. Viktor Ostrovsky, a member of the assassination team, former member of the assassination team, and of the author of a book that we have cited before on Taking Aim called By Way of Deception, the Kidon always uses weapons appropriate to their situation. Strangulation if the target is to be killed at night. An aerosol and syringe in the jugular to deliver a fast-acting nerve agent that kills and leaves no trace. Maya Dagan called Elisa Manningham Buller, the head of MI5, to inform her that his men would be operating across Great Britain. Next day, Katsas from Mossad headquarters in Brussels had flown into Heathrow Airport. 24 hours later, a four-man Kidon unit had arrived on the LL flight from Israel. Supporting them are the Mossad Yahalomin, the specialists at bugging phones and buildings. They were targeting a Leicester-based charity, accused of fundraising for Palestinian and Lebanese organizations. Margaret Thatcher acquiesced in these operations, no less so than Tony Blair. The killing machine across the planet.
Now, the killing machine targets dissidents and it targets heads of state. We spoke of Guatemala and the organized coup of the Arbenz, the attacks against the Arbenz regime that led to Jacobo Arbenz stepping down as president in Guatemala. Now, George Young, who in 1956, at the time he was deputy chief of MI6 in Great Britain, openly advocated the killing of Egyptian leader Gamal Abdel Nasser, and in September 1960, a senior foreign official, Howard Smith, who later became the director general of MI5, that's the comparable to our FBI, argued in an official document for the assassination of the young Congolese leader Patrice Lumumba, quote, I see only two possible solutions to the problem. The first is the simple one of ensuring his removal from the scene by killing him. That was the senior foreign office official Howard Smith, who later became the director general of MI5. So you have here a very open record in Israel, in Great Britain, and in the United States of targeted assassinations, of staging coups, of undermining governments, of attacking individuals, of stifling dissent, of stifling the organized expression of the workers in through their self-defense organizations such as trade unions. Ralph?
Dagan as a stone-cold killer. Richard Sale in the Jewish World Review and United Press International, Israel to kill in the United States and allied nations. Israel is embarking on an aggressive approach that will include staging targeted killings throughout the United States and other friendly countries, former U.S. and Israeli intelligence officials told United Press International. Sharon has acquiesced and supported these policies. Meir Dagan, the new director of Israel's Mossad Secret Intelligence Service, is preparing for a systematic campaign of killings in the United States and in Great Britain. In the United States and Great Britain. A former Israeli military intelligence source agreed. What Sharon wants is a much more extensive approach to global opposition, and this includes operation maneuverability. Does this mean assassination on the soils of allies, he was asked? It does, he said. Must quote Mossad as being beefed up. Its operations will proceed across the United States and Great Britain. Watch your back, writes Justin Raimondo. Mossad assassinations on American soil You can be certain of it. You who oppose the policies, you who write in opposition, you who organize around the issues of Zionism and of Israeli policies and the nature of the Israeli state. It is bone-chilling, the UPI story continues. We will now have the Mossad rampaging through the United States, eliminating the alleged enemies of Israel with an increasingly and desperate clock of Likudniks acting as judge, jury, and executioner. But the Likudniks and the Mossad do this in close coordination with American imperialism's rulers, with the Central Intelligence Agencies itself, and it is not for nothing that the CIA has provided Mossad snipers, as Gordon Thomas reported, with invisible bullets, invisible nickel-tipped bullets with no giveaway muzzle flash when fired, with no recoil, designed to be used in rifles that CIA armorers have developed with twice the range of ordinary sniper weapons and a killing accuracy of 1 to 2 miles. Weapons originally designed for use by special forces of the United States, now being integrated with the operations of the Kidon and the Katsas and the Mossad killers abroad. It is murder incorporated. It is the apparatus of the imperial state, from the Zionist state of Israel to its masters in Washington, from the DARPA to the murder squads. This is a structure of class war that targets the mass of the population in the United States, in Great Britain, those who resist, those who dissent, those who call out the nature of this rule are now to be targeted. Brothers and sisters, let's not pussyfoot about this. This is the apparatus of a murder state. We have to organize politically. We have to oppose it and always open to us. We have to break with the parties that sustain this class rule and begin that resistance, which is again and again and again a matter of the survival of the many at the hands of the rapacious few.
From murder incorporated to total control, the architecture of the police state. You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at Taking Aim at PacBell, that's PACBELL.net, or you can contact us at our WBAI voicemail, 212-209-2953. That's 212-209-2953. Our website is www.takingaim.info. We have on our website an archive of our programs since last August, and also some articles and an order form in case you want to order a cassette or CD copy of any of our shows or specials. We'll be with you next week.
Thank you very much, Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen, for Taking Aim. They'll be back next week, as they said, at 5 p.m. You are tuned to WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. Coming up.